welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the critic, Alison Baker. Alison, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back, Anthony. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm very happy that you came back. So tell us what you have come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around it, around its release, its reception, why it is maligned by people, and why you think that they are very wrong.
Well, I have come back with another hot garbage movie. The first time I was on to talk about Last Action Hero, which I argued was ahead of its time. This time I'm here to talk about 1998's ultra mega blockbuster, Armageddon. Armageddon was one of two end-of-the-world comet movies that was released in that year, the other one being Deep Impact. But Armageddon had the advantage of this crazy ensemble cast. It was a Jerry Bruckheimer and Michael Bay joint, and this is like pre-Transformers. Bruce Willis was their star, a baby Ben Affleck, who at that point really had pretty much done Good Will Hunting and some Kevin Smith films.
Right.
A bunch of other actors got their kind of big blockbuster breaks in that movie. It also came with a song by Aerosmith that played every hour on every radio station for like the next 3 years. Like that thing played at like the middle school dances I attended. Like, oh my God, I don't want to miss a thing if for some reason you did miss it.
Every moment spent with you is a moment I treasure.
I didn't know that was that written specifically for the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of genius, though.
Yes.
Considering, you know, Liv Tyler is in the movie.
That's why
I didn't know that.
I owned the sound. Okay, so here's why, like, I don't know, honestly, like, why Armageddon is maligned, like, now. I guess it's definitely a bloated, overdone, crazy blockbuster. There are plot holes that are massive. It's two different movies put together. There are a lot of like technical things wrong with it, but
just a few.
Yeah. But back when it came out, people loved it. People loved it. It made so much money. So much money.
$500 million, according to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And that was in 1998. So yeah, that's a lot.
Yes. And like the soundtrack was a massive seller because it was basically because of Liv Tyler being in the movie. It was a bunch of Aerosmith songs, like some Bon Jovi, the best cinematic use of ZZ Top that I've ever seen occurred in this movie. There are a lot of wrong reasons to use Aerosmith, but there's never a bad time to use ZZ Top. But like it was a huge deal. Like everyone saw it. It does not age awesome. So I'm going to go with that's why it has a star and a half on Netflix.
Why is that all it has?
I was shocked. I was like, this is at least like a 3-star romp. Come on. Like, Steve Buscemi is hilarious in this movie. I in middle school, I had this friend. Her name was Stephanie Smith, and she loved Bruce Willis. And so she dragged me to see this, and we must have seen it in theaters like 3 times. And then when it came out on VHS, you know, she bought it immediately. And every time we had a sleepover at her house, we were watching Armageddon. And so it was sort of like I came to love it by extension. Like, I just had a lot of attachment to it. I knew all of the characters, even the minor ones. I still think it's a fun movie. It's kind of weirdly a more innocent movie now because there's kind of this pre-9/11 disaster porn element to like let's destroy New York City that you kind of don't see as much in a grand scheme in movies anymore. But like there's also this sort of very adorable idea that, you know, we could just send a bunch of rednecks into space and they could save us. And I don't know, like maybe it's because I come from rednecks, but I'm very emotionally attached to that.
It really is a blue collar hero movie, isn't it? Like, you know, every, and that's quite common for Michael Bay movies, I think, you know, but it's, yeah, every anti-authoritarian character, every stance that they take, every decision made, if it's not sympathetic to the blue collar characters, turns out to be wrong. Or every argument that the blue collars have with the authority figures, the blue collars ultimately are the ones in the right and proven to be right. It's a very American movie in that sense. That seems to be like the sort of,
it's a Jeff Foxworthy thing. Like,
it's just a really populist thing in America, isn't it? It's that idea of, yeah, the blue collar working class ordinary frontier guy who is ultimately may not be as edumacated as the fancy experts, but ultimately knows best because of common sense.
Well, Mr. Stamper, what do you think?
You know, drilling's a science. It's an art. I'm a third generation driller, doing it all my life, and I still haven't got it all figured out. And I assume you sent for me because somebody told you I was the best. Well, I'm only the best because I work with the best. If you don't trust the men you're working with, you're as good as dead. If you want to send these boys into space, fine. Sure, they'll make good astronauts. They don't know jack about drilling. What's your contingency plan?
Contingency plan?
Your backup plan. You gotta have some kind of backup plan, right?
No, we don't have a backup plan. This is it.
And this is the best that you could, that the government, the U.S. government, can come up with? I mean, you're NASA, for crying out loud. You put a man on the moon. You're geniuses. You're the guys that think his shit up. I'm sure you got a team of men sitting around somewhere right now just thinking shit up and somebody backing them up. You telling me you have a backup plan that these 8 Boy Scouts right here, that is the world's hope? That's what you're telling me?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Damn it.
We're a little short on time here. Will you help us?
All they got to do is drill.
That's it.
No spacewalking, no crazy astronaut stuff?
Just drill.
How many men were you planning on taking up there?
We're sending up 2 shuttles, 2 teams.
If I do this, I'm going to want to take my own men.
You got it.
Exactly. Like, a good example is a pre-The Patriot Jason Isaacs is in this movie. Like, before Lucius Malfoy, before any of that, he plays this NASA scientist who basically, like, everything he does and says, Bruce Willis is like, you're an idiot, you did it wrong. Whereas when we're introduced to him, Keith David, another amazing actor who's in this film, he plays like this general, his position is MISC, Joint Chiefs of Staff, I don't know. He reports directly to the president, and he's the one that comes to NASA and is like, the president wants to do this. And then Jason Isaacs is like, you're absolutely wrong. And Billy Bob Thornton, this cast is amazing.
It really is, isn't it?
Billy Bob Thornton is like,
why don't we just send up 150 nuclear warheads and blast that rock apart?
Terrible idea.
Was I talking to you?
This is Dr. Ronald Quincy from research, pretty much the smartest man on the planet. You might want to listen to him.
So, like, he's established as the smartest man on the planet, and then a bunch of dudes who don't have, like, I think it's established that, like, a couple of the guys that are with Bruce Willis have degrees, but a bunch of them are just like, yeah, whatever, like, maybe I finished high school, I don't know. But apparently they know better than, like, this crazy MIT-educated, super smart NASA scientist.
So much of the movie, and we can get into more detail later, but so much of it, yeah, is flying by the seat of your pants, and yes, these guys ultimately somehow knowing more and being able to kind of bluff and improvise their way to success by ignoring all of the usual science that you would require for anything even approaching this sort of mission. It's just nuts. There was apparently a NASA advisor to this movie.
Yes.
I don't know what they did. I hope they earned a lot of money, because I can imagine that they must have been very, very frustrated.
Okay. So have you ever watched all the way to the end of the credits on this movie? I had never done it until last night.
Okay.
At the end of the credits, where they usually have all the stuff of, like, you know, animals were harmed and the making of this film, the characters contained are fictional, blah, 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 blah. Disclaimer, disclaimer. There is a disclaimer that says, while the National Aeronautics Space Administration consulted and provided assistance on this film, they do not endorse any of the content herein. And I was like, NASA burn! NASA burn you in your own credits!
Oh, that's brilliant. I didn't know that. I did know that, and this may be apocryphal, this, I don't know, this may not be true, but I like to hope that it is, that apparently NASA allegedly shows potential recruits this movie and asks them to list as many scientific inaccuracies as they can find, because there are apparently over 100. It is notorious within NASA as like one of the most scientifically inaccurate movies ever made.
Amazing.
About space travel.
That is amazing. I bet Neil deGrasse Tyson would probably have an aneurysm watching Armageddon. God, yeah. I mean, considering how he went like crazy on, what was the one with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney?
Gravity,
which was a great movie, way better done movie than this. But he like picked that one apart. Like, I feel like his head would just explode, really, and blood would come out his nose, and he would just be done. But I don't know if that's true or not. I wouldn't be surprised. I love that the core concept of this movie is rather than take astronauts and teach them how to drill,
it's take drillers and teach them how to be astronauts in 12 days.
12 days! And by the way, that means they have 8 hours to complete their mission. Like, by the time they actually land on the asteroid, they've given them a window of 8 hours, like a work day. You have one 9-to-5 work day to drill a hole, plant a nuke, fly off the asteroid. Like,
I hadn't considered that that's a standard work day, but that can't be a coincidence. That's got to be, yeah, you're absolutely right, a reference to the standard 8-hour 9-to-5 work day. Oh, God, I can't believe I didn't realize that.
Like, I don't know whether that was a thematic choice or whether they were just like, I guess we want to give them as much time to train as possible because we have to give them a night off to hang out with strippers and play with animal crackers. My God, that animal cracker scene, I used to like think that was the end all be all of romantic when I was like 13.
Well, of course, yeah.
And now I'm like, oh God, I'm having secondhand embarrassment from this scene.
Makes your toes curl, yeah. You said that the way you described it being always on at your friend's sleepovers. So, see, for me and my friends, our equivalent movie for that, it was always on in the background. If we were playing a board game, it'd be on. If we had a sleepover, it'd be on while we were, you know, doing something else. Was Aliens.
Such a better movie.
Right. But such a more boys movie. You know, I have seen Aliens got to be close to 100 times, one way or another, because it was just always on. And it sounds like this was kind of your equivalent. And it is a much more, I mean, this is much more of a romance and has a love story right at the heart of it.
It does. It's very character driven, which isn't surprising if you consider J.J. Abrams wrote this movie.
Well, J.J. Abrams was one of the writers.
Yes, there was two writers
brought on to rewrite the movie.
Nice try, J.J. Abrams. Like, and also one of the executive producers of this film was Gail Ann Hurd of The Walking Dead fame.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that. Well, and also, I mean, Gail Ann Hurd, for many, many years, was the producer for, well, she started as an assistant to Roger Corman.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and she also worked with, talking about Aliens, with Cameron. Ooh. For many, many years. Produced The Terminator, Aliens. I think she did The Abyss as well. Yeah, so in fact, she was married to Cameron. Yes, of course she was. Yeah, she was married.
I never
to James
knew
Cameron.
That about her.
Yeah, so on the one hand, I mean, those are all better movies than this. But on the other hand, you can see where she might be like, yeah, okay, that sounds like fun, and there's stuff I can bring to this. You know, you can see why she might get involved in a project like this, because it is big space action.
It does, but then unfortunately it Michael Bay's itself. I wonder, like, since there's only two actual, like, actresses in this movie, like, which of them had to wear a bikini and wash his car to audition,
right,
like he forced Megan Fox to do. But yeah, like, also, Michael Bay put himself in this movie.
Yes, as a NASA scientist.
I was like,
doesn't say anything though, doesn't have any speaking.
No, but still, I was like, really? Really? Come on.
Well, when you're spending $140 million in 1998 again, remember, so that's an incredibly expensive movie. That would be the equivalent of, what, a $250 million picture today. You know, yeah, I can kind of understand that he might want a bit of screen time.
Yeah. what I find really weird about this movie watching it now is that it's kind of two different movies. The first half of the movie is kind of this father-daughter and boy-girl kind of, like, there's a lot of relationships playing out, and there's a lot of comedy, a lot of lightheartedness. They spend, like, a solid half an hour rounding up all the different guys, and we get to know all of the different drillers. Michael Clark Duncan, fantastic, I think, rightly missed actor, who I think this was his big sort of film break, because this is before he did the Green Mile or anything like that. Owen Wilson, the first time anyone realized Luke Wilson had a brother in this film. And so, like, they round everybody up and we get to know them. We have a training montage, the random sequences with the psychiatrist in that room with the pointy things coming out of the walls.
Right, an anechoic chamber. It's like, why do you need that? They use that to baffle sound and signals. That's the sort of room that mobile phones get tested in.
Okay, I was like, what is that for? I don't get it. I'm supposed to believe that Steve Buscemi is some kind of child prodigy, science genius.
Look, you want to compare brain pans? I won the Westinghouse Prize when I was 12. Big deal. Published at 19, so what? I got a double doctorate from MIT at 22. Chemistry and geology. I taught at Princeton for 2.5 years. Why do I do this? Because the money's good, the scenery changes, and they let me use explosives, okay?
Which, you know what? I'll take it. Like, I'll accept that. I will accept that at face value. I love Steve Buscemi. I love him. Like, I don't think he can do anything wrong. And I'm counting all of the terrible Adam Sandler movies he's been in.
Bill Fichtner, who it plays the NASA, you know, the hard nosed NASA pilot who takes them up there.
Oh, I didn't even know who that was. Oh, are you talking about the Colonel guy who, like, they have a freak out later and he tries to shoot them?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I recognize that guy, and I was like, have I seen him before? Was it on, like, some Nickelodeon show? I don't, like...
yeah, that's William Fichtner. You've seen him. It's hard to point to a specific, you know, like, TV show or big movie other than this that you'll have seen him in, but you will have seen him in things. He was in, actually, if you remember, in the wake of the success of stuff like Lost, there was a whole rash of mystery network series, and one of them was called Invasion. About doppelgangers down in the Florida swamps, he was the sheriff.
Yes! Oh my god, okay. Oh, what is the name of that actor who was like Billy Bob Thornton's wingman the whole time? That character actor, big southern accent, worked at NASA.
Oh, I don't know.
Like, I've seen him in a million things too. This movie is like bleeding character actors.
It really, well, and we haven't even mentioned Peter Stormare.
Oh my god.
Who plays the Russian astronaut, or cosmonaut, I should say.
His character is probably now my favorite because he's just, like, clearly insane. They're just like, yeah, do this. You're going to be the only actual astronaut who's, like, going to be with these dudes at the end. Like, do this.
And you're nuts.
You're nuts. You're weirdly still into the Soviet Union. Like, you're wearing, like, t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, the psychologist, by the way, is played by Udo Kier.
Oh, my God.
Another actor that you'll have seen in various things, but not everybody knows his name.
He's my husband's favorite video game voice actor.
Oh, he does a lot of that, yeah. He also plays Hans in My Own Private Idaho, if you've seen that.
I have not seen that. I'm going to...
Yeah, the gay traveling salesman. Yeah,
oh, my God.
He's great in that.
This movie is insane. Like, I can see why on paper someone was like, Yeah, okay. This will make like $1 billion. This is
yeah, you can have $140 million. Yeah, looking at the cards.
Do it. This is awesome. Let's do this. but then like they made the movie and the first half of it's kind of like this relationship driven sort of comedy drama. And then the back half of it is the space adventure.
Right. It's like a heist movie.
Yeah, a little
like
bit.
Like the way they assemble the team and then it's like, okay, now and here's the heist, or in this case, here's the mission.
Yeah. And then they kind of they move very quickly through a lot of the actual, they don't actually spend that much time. It's like the last 45 minutes of the movie are kind of the core of the stuff happening on the asteroid. Cause it takes them like almost an hour and a half to get to space.
Well, and they're also not actually in space for very long. It only seems to take like 5 minutes to fly from Earth to the moon.
Yeah. Well, and there's that weird stop off at the Russian. Okay, first off, the Russian space station. Was that like a precursor to the? Oh, so that was supposed to be Mir. Okay.
I think so. Yeah.
I remember
Mir.
Well,
I assumed so.
I remember Mir. I was like, oh my gosh, this is pre-ISS. What's going on?
Yeah.
That entire sequence is pointless. You don't need that at all. You just be like, yeah, you're going to stop off and refuel and go. But we had like a whole thing where we meet Lev and we're messing around in the space station and then it's got to explode and we have to save people. Like, it's like a weird place to put an action climax.
Right. It is really weird. Especially, and also just another small sort of logic point. The fact that Peter Stormare's character is up there on his own.
Yeah.
It's like, what? That never happens.
That's not how you space.
Yeah. And they're saying like he's been up there for 18 months on his own. It's like, are you crazy?
I did love like the weird like cadence he adopted. Like,
yeah,
he did not sound like his Fargo character at all. He sounded like this sort of, like, it was almost like he was combining a southern drawl with his Russian accent, like stretching out his words. And
he didn't even sound particularly Russian. I mean, he's not Russian. He's Swedish. So, you know, he's putting on several layers of accent for that role.
Welcome, everybody. I am not gas station. This is sophisticated laboratory. I'm in charge. So do not be touching anything.
I think he failed. I'm just going to put that out there that I think he failed. I still love his character. Like, his character is like the most bananas. And it's just like, yeah, let's jump this canyon. I don't care. Like,
oh, God, yeah.
They just jumped a canyon in a tank.
In a tank on an asteroid that has a surprising amount of gravity, considering how small it is.
Yeah, I also like the landscape that they're traversing in the tank is like wildly different from like this gothic. It's like if H.R. Giger and the people that designed Krypton like collaborated to create the asteroid landscape, at least like the one that we see most of the time, like all those spiky things sticking out, and it's very dark and spooky. For some reason, the asteroid roars like a lion, like it has a voice, and it's got its own creepy soundtrack theme. Like,
yeah, and it's got winds blowing across it for some reason.
It's got like that weird smoky stuff there. Yeah. Like, it's like the asteroid's almost like sentient.
It is just so weird. The landscape is like every asteroid that we have ever seen from Earth is smooth. I mean, pockmarked with from impacts and stuff, sure, but it's basically smooth. It does not have random spiky bits of rock and ice 20 feet tall sticking out at all angles.
It's not like a space flail like coming at you. Right. Oh my God. So I will say though that like at least all that character building that they do in the first half of the movie, it does make, like, it makes you stay invested for the second half. At least it works for me, because I'm like, oh, I care about these people. Like, when Max gets blown into space, I'm like, oh, no, you were funny. You got a tattoo for your mom. You like donuts. Like, I know things about you, and so I care. A thing that bugged me when I was a kid and still bugs me now is that, like, Liv Tyler doesn't have anything to do.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the female astronaut as well. The only time that she has something important to do, she can't manage right at the end. She can't manage to do it.
Yeah.
And the Russian has to basically throw her off and say, let me handle it instead.
Yeah. Step aside a little bit. At least at that point, it's like one astronaut being like, he's pulling rank, hopefully not just as a man, but as a more experienced astronaut. Like at that point, I can, like, if it had been anyone else other than him, it would have been like, no, guys, come on. Come on.
He does make a repetitive point that he's the only actual astronaut there, doesn't he? So,
like, okay, at least you, in theory, can space. Though I'm pretty sure even, like, cosmonauts aren't taught, like, yeah, hit it with a wrench.
Right.
Keep hitting it.
Yeah. Well, or let the fuel transfer valves and stuff in the Russian space station get into such a ridiculously poor state of repair.
But Anthony is up there by himself. He can't check all that stuff.
It's just, and then leaves like the American guy down there by himself, like, oh, just do this, it'll be fine, and if this goes wrong, don't worry about it, just pull this lever.
It's cool. It's like a Looney Tune setup, and honestly, like, those are the things I love about it. Like, the justification for any of this is paper thin, but, like, right, I'm still compelled to watch it. It's a 2.5 hour movie. That is a slog. And, like, I think a lot of it owes to, like, it's the cast. It's the sheer star power and charisma of the people on the screen. Like, when Billy Bob Thornton delivers his one requisite F-bomb for 90s PG-13 movies, PG-13 movies in the 90s, you got one F-bomb. And he, like, throws it out there, like, basically at the president and at Keith David. Right. It's like, yeah, I am behind you, Billy Bob Thornton.
This is what I mean about the blue collar thing. It's like, yeah, they save that one moment for basically telling the president to F off.
But at least Billy Bob Thornton's character is, like, the head NASA guy. So it's like, that's the one moment where, like, the nerd is victorious. Like, otherwise, it's like a sea of Jason Isaacs looking dejected because, like, all of the amazing things he's designed are just being torn apart and they're ignoring how to use anything. Like, but no, like, if it weren't for, like, Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck and, like, Michael Clark Duncan's character has, like, amazing one-liners all throughout. Like, if it weren't for, like, the people in the movie delivering their ridiculous lines the way they're delivering them, the movie has nothing to offer, in my mind.
Right, yeah. No, on that, I absolutely agree that all of the characters, pretty much all of the actors, are very well cast. They're all people that you can enjoy watching be, you know, their characters. I mean, you know, none of them are really stretching themselves, let's be honest,
no,
in terms of the characters they're playing. Billy Bob Thornton is probably the most playing against type character in it, and even he's not that much against type. So, but it is fun to just watch these great actors, and they are all really good actors. You know, not all of them are Olivier, sure, but they're all really, really good at what they do. And this movie lets them do that for 2.5 hours. So in that respect, yeah, I agree. It's entertaining just to watch them and to enjoy seeing them all go about their business on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even, like, from the opening of the movie, there's that random cameo by, what's his name? Mark Curry? Is that his name? Stand-up comedian from the 90s. He plays a cab driver, and he's got these two Japanese tourists in the back of his cab in New York City. And
oh, was he a comedian?
Yeah, he was a stand-up comedian. He used to do, like, Premium Blend and things like that here in the U.S. Like, you'd see him on Comedy Central all the time. He's just got this cameo where he's just, like, he's being funny in his cab. And then, like, you know, asteroids start hitting. Which, did you notice the asteroids are super courteous and follow the avenues?
Yes, I did.
I also have to wonder, like, how many times has Grand Central Station been blown up in movies? Because, like, everyone loves to do it. And I've now been there, and I'm, like, every time I go, I'm like, man, an asteroid came through this wall, and Hulk came through that wall, and, like, like, what?
Well, and it's such a lovely building as well. What a shame.
It's beautiful. I don't know, man. It's, from the beginning, it's, like, setting itself up as, like, something that's supposed to be super relatable. And then I do kind of admire kind of like, you're right, it's a very American, very blue-collar movie, because, like, all of the, you know, vignette pieces of, like, looking at the world coming together in prayer and stuff for...
Right, and everybody's basically just going, yes, America, save us!
Yeah, it's all, and like, half the shots are, like, of these weird small towns in America that don't actually exist. Like, they gather around in a barn to watch a television, and I'm like, where is this? Like, show me some people, like, at... like a Radio Shack outside of a Claire's if you want to do like 90s America, like do that. Like I do admire at least like the idea that like, oh, we're like it's a planetary unity. Like we put aside our conflicts, you know, we're going to try to get together and just get through this as a people. It honestly, it reminds me of, I mean, Independence Day did the exact same thing.
Right.
2 years earlier, like the Americans have to save everybody at the end. And the American president gives a better speech. The Bill Pullman speech kicked this speech's butt. But, you know, gives the rallying cry to unite all of these different forces. So I think that's just a thing that Americans like,
oh, sure. Yeah. That's just what I meant about it being populist. Yeah. It's, you know, yeah. America is, you know, the greatest country on earth and is going to save the world, and the rest of the world will be extremely grateful.
Yes. We're all going to get along and we like being like global society, but we're in charge of it.
Right. Just so long as we're number one, which, you know, I mean, that's hardly a uniquely American trait. It's just that because America exports the most popular movies, you know, in the world, obviously we see it mostly from America. But, you know, that's, I'm not knocking America per se, because that's hardly a trait unique to America.
If y'all had Bruce Willis, you would do the same thing.
Right. Oh, he is so Bruce Willis in this. He's just... this is his prototypical archetypal role, isn't it?
It's very much like if John McClane like got old and retired from being a cop and decided to go into oil drilling. And it's fantastic. Like we first meet him in the scene where they play that LaGrange riff in the beginning of the song, great ZZ Top song. And then he's just golfing on an oil rig and he's hitting golf balls at a Greenpeace boat.
Yeah.
and like that is immediately everything we need to know about him. Though I am weirded out by like how he lives on the oil rig. Like, where does everyone sleep? Like, we saw like this weird cabin that Ben Affleck slept in, but like I don't know. Like, the mechanics of that weirded me. I don't know anything about oil rigs, but I'm
pretty sure that people do live, you know, that workers do live on oil rigs, that there are quarters there,
okay,
because they're so often so far out to sea. However, what little I know of oil rigs, which is very, very little, suggests that the depiction of working life and certainly safety practices depicted here on this oil rig do not bear much resemblance to reality.
Yeah, Bruce Willis using a shotgun to dispense fatherly justice. See, I was like, you're literally working around a lot of flammable stuff right now. Like, right. Maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you should stop.
Maybe not. And also, people are running around without hard hats.
Oh, yeah.
The visitors, you know, just being led around this oil rig with no hard hats or protective equipment, not even high-vis jackets.
Yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah, my husband was watching part of, like, the beginning of the movie with me before he walked away. Because he didn't have to. He worked construction when he was growing up, and his father is a construction worker, and his grandfather, and he was just, like, shaking his head. He was like, none of that. No, that is all. That's just OSHA violations on top of OSHA violations on top. Like, no, it's so wrong. Like,
I didn't know that. So he's just offended by the first 20 minutes.
Oh yeah. I mean, he still works adjacent to the construction industry. He has a collection of hard hats, in fact, are mounted to our wall. And I was like, man, like maybe those could have gone to those dudes, because that's just really unsafe. But, you know, it's okay because they're only on the rig for like, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And then they're in space and they have helmets.
Right. Different helmets, yeah. And even those they don't wear half the time.
No. Maybe I don't know how like pressurization and stuff works. It seemed like there was a lot of times where people should have just been sucked into a vacuum and they weren't.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, and the sheer amount of space inside the if you'll pardon the pun, inside the space shuttle that they, I mean, these are clearly meant to be, you know, they say that they're secret project advanced technology shuttles of the future, but these things are enormous.
Yeah,
enormous. They're like the size of half an aircraft hangar by themselves inside.
Look, they were pretty and they were cool, and I remember my dad got me like the little like toy of one of them and used to play with it. I also had the action figure of Ben Affleck because my friend had the Bruce Willis one. Like, we really liked that movie. Really liked it.
Wow.
I mean, it's, I don't know. It was a fun movie. It's definitely a movie you have to turn your brain off to watch. And even with your brain turned off, there are some things where you're like, even from the beginning, and I noticed this when I was a kid, you know, there's that ominous narration explaining the destruction of the dinosaurs, the last extinction mm-hmm. level event. The Earth that they're showing us is the current Earth.
Right.
Like, the continents are laid out the way they are. And I'm like, y'all missed some stuff. Like,
well, and also when the meteor hits and there's that kind of fire ball that spreads across yeah. the Earth. Like, what? Where did that come from? And you know that's narrated by Charlton Heston, by the way.
Is that Charlton Heston?
Yes, it is.
That is amazing.
This is the Earth at a time when the dinosaurs roamed a lush and fertile planet. A piece of rock just 6 miles wide changed all that. It hit with the force of 10,000 nuclear weapons. A trillion tons of dirt and rock hurtled into the atmosphere, creating a suffocating blanket of dust the sun was powerless to penetrate for 1,000 years. It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
What I love about that, though, more even than the spreading fireball and stuff, is that it then cuts to the present day, and it has a title card saying 65 million years later.
Which, you wouldn't know.
I just love that.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm not going to recover from that.
What, the Charlton Heston line?
Yeah, I'm not.
One of the things people complained about with this movie when it came out as well, and I remember this just being a sort of criticism of Michael Bay's movies in general, was the frenetic pace of the editing, like the fast cutting
yes.
style, and the camera never rests, and there's edit, edit, edit. And I mean, I remember that at the time, and I remember agreeing, but looking back now, watching it now, it seems almost quaint.
Yeah.
Like, this is practically a sort of slow-moving Victorian period piece compared to a lot of modern action movies. It,
compared
you know?
To, like, Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen. Yeah,
Right, yeah.
And there are moments in the movie where I did notice, you know, watching it this most recent time, I noticed weird editing cuts where, like, and the ADR wasn't quite done right. Like, the audio wasn't lining up.
Right.
Like, it was like, you clearly are just trying to, like, You're shaving seconds, like trying to compress this thing. It's like a club sandwich that's too big and it's full of lots of delicious
it's
stuff.
It's already 2.5 hours
yeah,
long. Yeah,
it's full of delicious things that you want to eat all of it, but you have to squish it to get it in your mouth. It's
apparently Ben Affleck asked Michael Bay on going back to something you said earlier. He asked Michael Bay on set, like, why is it easier to train drillers to be astronauts instead of training astronauts to drill? And Bay apparently just said, shut the bleep up. And Ben Affleck said, and that was the end of that conversation.
And this was like Ben Affleck's big follow-up to like the Oscar-winning Good Will Hunting. Like, that he co-wrote, like, everyone was like, him and Matt Damon are these intellectuals. They're, like, soft bros, you know? Like, they're men's men, but they're, like, they got brains and hearts. Like, just this good boy from Boston. And then it's like he did the most brainless action movie he could possibly do. But you know what? He made so much money.
Well, and what did Matt Damon do? I mean, okay, he made stuff like Mr. Ripley, which was great. But, you know, what's his biggest franchise? It's a fairly, you know, equally, not quite so brainless, but not far off, you know, spy action series. So, you know.
I do find it interesting that, like, after this, like, Ben Affleck in the 90s, like, this was his biggest action movie. But then, and otherwise, like, he did a lot of rom-com. Like, tons of rom-com. And, like, Daredevil happened, and we pretend that it didn't. Because it did not go.
I still think he was good in that. It was a bad movie, but he was good.
And Michael Clarke Duncan was in that with him.
Oh, yes.
As Kingpin.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
I had not read a Marvel comic in my life when I saw that movie, so I was just like, what is this?
You weren't familiar with Daredevil from the comics at all?
No, I didn't.
Oh, wow.
I think, like, the only Marvel characters that I think I knew back then were, like, Captain America and the Hulk. Like, that, and Spider-Man. Like, I knew those because the Spider-Man movies were out.
Right, you knew the headline characters.
Yeah. I think that Ben Affleck, though, like, deserved better from this movie. Like, a lot of his heroism is kind of handed to him by Bruce Willis. Like, he doesn't get to do anything heroic until Bruce Willis tells him he can.
Yeah, gives him permission to be heroic.
It's like, yeah, okay. Which, by the way, the whole success of the mission hinges on him doing something that resulted in catastrophic failure in their simulation. Like, they did the simulation in the pool, and he blew the transmission, and it was the exact same thing, and then that thing happened. It's basically like, you did the practice test, and the problem from the practice test ended up on the real test. You know how to handle this. And he's just like, I have learned nothing! I'm just gonna keep doing this!
And it works.
And then it works. Everyone comes back to Earth having learned nothing.
Yep, once again, just like, no, ignore the scientists, ignore the eggheads, the boffins, I know best, trust my drilling instincts.
It's very, I feel like this would have been Stephen Colbert, the character's favorite movie, like, because it's all, like, about going with your gut and American exceptionalism, you know, and also it's got that cute wedding scene at the end. Like, I don't know. They filmed...
So unnecessary.
They filmed an entire wedding and, like, played it over the credits. And it's basically just a bunch of, like, sequences of them throwing cake at each other, which I'm sure was really cathartic for the cast.
Lots of close-ups of Liv Tyler, you know, sort of smiling and looking beautiful at the camera, and all the rest of the cast kissing her for some reason.
That is Liv Tyler's whole thing. I hate to say it. She's a beautiful woman, but she's no actress. I mean, she was as useless in this as she was in the entire Lord of the Rings series. Arwen was pointless. Arwen is pointless. She sits around looking pretty and sad. That is her entire deal.
She does look very pretty, though.
Gorgeous. Can't believe she came from Steven Tyler. Like,
it is kind of hard to believe, actually, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, there are G-forces in space. That's the other... I forgot about that, yeah.
Oh, my God. Make slingshot around the moon.
Yeah. And they're all like, oh, I can't take the G-forces. You're like, you're in space. And then they fly through the debris field like they're flying fighter jets.
Yep.
Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh. This film, as it were, is a mess, but it's a mess I have deep affection for. It's not something I can watch regularly. This is like every 5 years it's on TV, probably around Thanksgiving, and it's like, I am going to watch Armageddon, like, right now.
Right.
It also, like, I'm wondering why it kicked the ass of Deep Impact.
Well, I haven't seen Deep Impact, but I gather that it's much more scientifically accurate. And which, let's be honest, that's a low bar. But I suspect that that probably just makes it less, you know, exciting, less overtly actiony, because this is basically an action comedy sci-fi. This is not an actual, you know, at no point does anybody follow any kind of procedure related to the real world in any way. It is as much a silly action movie as, I don't know, The Magnificent Seven or, you know, RoboCop or something. There is nothing in here even remotely related to the real world. But that's because it's just thrilling. The whole thing is a massive thrilling roller coaster ride, whereas I gather Deep Impact was much more, not cerebral as such, but just had a lot more science and actual accuracy in it, which by definition means that it's less thrilling and exciting.
It doesn't have Fantasy NASA, which, man, Fantasy NASA had such a big budget. It's so awesome to see a NASA with a budget.
Except for their budget to monitor giant approaching meteors, apparently.
Begging your pardon, sir, but it's a big-ass sky.
How could they not see it? He just said it's the size of Texas, for heaven's sake.
Apparently, it is true that, the budget for, especially in the late 90s, for, monitoring threats from space was, you basically can cover, 3%. Now, the way, our satellite technology works is you do, you check here in a swath, and then you move over here a few degrees, and you check here in a swath. You don't just, spend forever on the same 3%. You look at different bits.
It only takes three, even if you only can only do 3% in a night, it only takes 3 months to then cover 100%.
Yeah, you'll figure it out. honestly, I wonder if also, the fact that this, the star power of this cast, and having Aerosmith associated with it, it's basically a big power metal concert of a movie, just sort of steamrolled over Deep Impact. Because Deep Impact, the only actor I can remember from that movie is, I think, Tia Leone was in that. And this was
Robert Duvall, Tia Leone, and Morgan Freeman.
Okay, and this was back when Tia Leone was still married to David Duchovny.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so, and Morgan Freeman wasn't as well-known outside of Shawshank at that point. He wasn't the giant star that he is now.
It was only a couple of years after Seven, which felt like his sort of, post stuff like Driving Miss Daisy, felt like the start of his, not breakout as such, but that was the first movie that a lot of people I know saw him in. Because it was, a movie aimed at sort of, young men, basically.
I don't know, over here, literally everyone saw Shawshank. Everyone saw Shawshank.
That was 95, so yeah.
But then, after that, it was sort of he did smaller stuff. And then you're right, Seven was his next big thing. I have no memory of Robert Duvall being in Deep Impact.
I've never even seen it, so the thing is, I thought I'd seen this years ago on DVD or even on late night TV, but then I started watching it and there were so many bits where I'm like, I don't remember this at all. I'm not sure if I had seen it.
Maybe.
Other than maybe just segments here and there. I don't know.
You had seen, you don't have to see the whole movie to know the plot of the movie.
Oh God, no. No, literally the premise. I just knowing the premise, if you know anything at all about, especially Michael Bay movies, but just Hollywood action movies in general, just give you the premise and you'll be like, yeah, okay, I can figure how that's going to go. And you'd be right.
Oh my God.
But I was just laughing the whole way through. You're right that the first half is a comedy. Or not a comedy, but it has lots of comedy moments and is lighthearted, and the second half is all the action. But I was laughing just as much in the second half because it was just so outlandish and absurd. It makes Star Wars look like NCIS or something. It's just...
Well, at least Star Wars has, there's internal rules and logic.
That's what I mean.
With any movie, if it's fantasy, if it's sci-fi, if it's hard sci-fi or soft sci-fi, if it's urban fantasy, whatever permutation of those genres, if you have an internal logic and rules that you don't even have to explain them, as long as they feel consistent, you're golden. Do whatever the hell you want. That's why, the reason the Star Wars prequels present so many issues that the originals don't have is that George Lucas tried to over-explain his own premise. and didn't have, like, it was like, no, you're not doing a science fiction piece. Like, we don't need midichlorians. We don't over-explain.
Yeah, stop.
Stop. We already accepted the Force and hyperdrive and everything else. Like, you had us at hello. So I think this movie a lot of times ignores its own, it contradicts itself in a lot of ways. And you're presented as a viewer with a choice of worry about that contradiction or enjoy the movie.
Right, or just enjoy the explosions. And there are, for a movie of this, there are a surprising amount of explosions. I mean, why does the rover have rotary cannon?
I don't know!
I do not understand, because they never mention it before. It's just, oh, it's there.
And remember when they first see the armadillo, they start pulling it apart and pulling things off of it, and, like, the NASA yeah. guys are like, oh, God, you're breaking it. They left the gun on?
Yeah.
Of course they did. Of
the giant
they did.
Rotary cannon.
But we might need this machine gun on the front of this.
Hey, good thing they did. Oh, man. Yeah. But you're right. You have to. You can either get bogged down in that stuff. And then, like I say, I admit I was laughing at just how ridiculous it was. But not in a sort of, I mean, they clearly just didn't care.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a sense, you kind of have to respect that they just don't care. They're like, don't care. We want to make an exciting, thrilling movie. But that's not how, it doesn't matter. But that wouldn't, doesn't matter. Don't care. Let's just, you know, be exciting.
Punctuated, by the way, with scenes of the most horrible destruction you've ever seen. Like, they eliminate Shanghai
oh, yeah.
and Paris as an afterthought.
Yeah.
It's like, oh,
just flattened.
Just
yeah.
to remind you, these are coming. There's some asteroids. Millions are dead. Millions of people are dead. Cut back to the asteroid, and, like, Steve Buscemi's riding on a warhead. Like,
yeah, doing his Slim Pickens impression.
Which is hilarious, but it's like, oh, all those people are dead. Like,
yeah, things like the personnel locators.
Oh, my
like,
God.
They just switched them on to halfway. Why weren't they on the whole time? They just get to the Russian station and then, oh, by the way, we've all got personnel locators, by the way. Oh, right, I'll switch those on. The communications are all in real time.
Yeah.
There's no delay. They have better real-time communication than we have over cell phones.
It's amazing. That NASA, oh, fantasy dear. NASA, is a great NASA. Like,
oh, it even has a better front of building than real NASA. Did you notice that?
Yes, I did. I was like, there's no way that's NASA.
Yeah. Yeah. And when they pull up outside the building, it's just got that massive, it looks like an airport that they just stuck a huge NASA sign over the
yeah,
door.
It probably is. Like, I would not be surprised if you told me that. I mean, airports are useful for movies. They used my local airport for Indiana Jones, for The Last Crusade. The blip takes off from the old building of National Airport. But that is an airport standing in for another thing.
For an airport.
That launches things into the sky. That makes sense. Like,
well, NASA launches things into the sky.
I guess, yeah. Trying to map now, and I've seen the space shuttle in person. It flew overhead when they were decommissioning, was it Discovery?
Oh, right.
Yeah, they did, they flew it down, because they keep one of the shuttles at the Udvar Hazy. There's two Smithsonian Air and Space Museums. There's the one on the National Mall in the heart of Washington, D.C., and one at the Udvar Hazy Space Center, which is out in sort of western Fairfax County to the west of the city, and it's got a giant hangar. It's where they store at least one of the decommissioned shuttles. And I remember when they were decommissioning the last one, they did like the they flew it on the back of another plane kind of down the eastern seaboard, and like everyone in the middle of the day like went out onto the mall, like came out of their offices, and like I was in Arlington, and like we went up to the rooftop and saw the space shuttle fly overhead. It was like, that part's really cool. I think that's honestly what hooks me into this movie, is I love space. I love stuff about space and space travel. Super hyped that they like decided to tie this movie into like all of the stuff we have, was because we were planning for a manned mission to Mars.
Right.
Which is like, oh, this is before Curiosity. Like, we still don't have a manned mission to Mars. What the hell is that? You know? But I don't know. There's parts of this movie that make me all excited about, like, the possibilities. And then there are the parts of the movie that are just like, you don't even have the excuse of reading Wikipedia. Like, you just read the back cover of some books and, like, taped this thing together. Good job.
Yep. Oh, man. I mean, I would have joined you watching the shuttle fly overhead on the Eastern Seaboard, that's for sure. Giving you some idea of my age, I remember watching the first space shuttle launch when I was a kid. My school, and this was, I mean, it was junior school, you know, it was like I was very young, but nevertheless, my school gathered everybody around a TV set in the, you know, in the sort of community area to watch the launch of the very first space shuttle.
Oh, cool.
And it was amazing.
It is so cool.
Yeah. I was literally like 9 years old. So, but I do remember it. I've always remembered it because it was amazing. Yeah. The space shuttle was amazing. It's such a shame that, you know, that it's retired. I mean, yeah, I know all the arguments about inefficiency and stuff, but really, a bit like Concorde, it's kind of like, you know, considering the amount of money we spend on plenty of other stuff that doesn't need to happen, you could afford to spend a few billion even, yeah, on keeping programs like that going because they are so inspirational.
Well, and like necessary, like space, it's out there. We should look at it. Like
kind of important. Yeah.
and it's fun to me that like for a planet really that is so obsessed with exploration and, you know, especially like Western popular culture is so into sci-fi, like, you'd think there'd be more of like the exploratory kind of like that explorer's heart, like when it comes to wanting to push out. But like, it's weird. Like the late 90s had this weird trend of like, space is going to kill us. Whether it's with an alien invasion or with asteroids or with the Mars Attacks remake, like it's going to kill us. Space is going to kill us. It's like someone somewhere was like, we're all going to become like the Leonard McCoy of the Enterprise crew. Like, Bones was convinced that all of space was going to kill him all the time, and that's, like, as of the late 90s, that's where we were at.
The Bones McCoy, I like that, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I just, as I say, I'm not actually sure. Maybe I blocked it from my memory, I don't know, but I'm not actually sure if I had ever seen this before. And now, having seen it, I don't know if I'll ever watch it again. But at the same time, I almost certainly won't switch over if it comes on the TV, you know?
I think that's like the exact niche that this movie occupies.
Maybe so. Oh, dear. But yeah, I mean, I'm certainly, you know, I'm glad now that I have seen it and remember seeing it. If nothing else, just because as a point of comparison to modern movies, like, could you get to further sort of movies than this and Gravity, for example?
Yeah, oh my god.
You know, it pulls apart.
Like, if only because it was, you know, Gravity decided to, you know, do the same kind of thrills with, like, one-tenth of the cast.
Right, and budget.
Like, well, okay, you had 40 people, we're just going to settle on two.
But yeah, as I say, I am, you know, ultimately, I'm glad that I've seen it again, maybe, or for the first time. I don't know. But it was certainly worth, I had a good laugh.
I'm glad. Watching it, I'm so glad that I was able to subject to this.
And I'm very glad that you chose it. And thank you for coming on and talking about it. So I know that you were on the show before, as you mentioned earlier. However, you have sort of changed venue a bit for your comics criticism and stuff. So where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, you can still find me on Twitter at VA Gentle Nerd. VA is in the abbreviation for the state of Virginia. And just Gentle Nerd. It's spelled the way it sounds. And I am no longer really with Comicosity anymore. I have moved over to Comics Bulletin, comicsbulletin.com, the hot cousin of comics journalism, as we bill ourselves. I am their new editor for special projects. Right now, I am curating a project focused on the John Ostrander, Kim Yale, Luke McDonald Suicide Squad from the late 80s and early 90s. We're doing a lot of essays and character profiles and sort of arc highlights. Got a lot of other stuff planned, some interviews that we're lining up. And it's a great site generally. There's a lot of coverage from everything from Big Two down to small press. Keep your eyes peeled for a future podcast endeavor. Also, I've got a podcast about the show Preacher called Gone to Texas. So you can find us on Twitter at @gone2txshow. And I would also encourage you to follow my co-host, Mike Garvey, at @avantgarv. And I think those are all the places I live.
Awesome. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at UMP.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This movie is ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It really is.
Like, every bit of it. And what's weird is, like, the way they try to combine the laughs with the horrible death, like, from, like, when the Samoan guy gets hit by the meteor at the beginning, and it's, like, the dude's freaking out because his dog is in the hole, and he's like, somebody dial 911, and it's like, that man is dead.
Yeah.
Thousands of people are dying.
Right, and so are hundreds of other people in your immediate vicinity. Yeah,
like it's.
Did you ever see Space Cowboys?
I did not. It did. Like, I remember when it came out, I took a hard pass on it, though.
See, that's one that I definitely have seen, and I actually quite
enjoyed
it.
That's the one with Tommy Lee Jones, right? And Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
Yeah, I might need to revisit that one.
It's, it's almost as ridiculous as this. Not quite, because not many things are. But yeah, it's Eastwood, Tommy Lee Jones, Donald Sutherland, James Garner.
Jesus
That's it.
Christ!
Yeah. Really, like, stellar cast. And they're all Air Force, sorry. test pilots. So, you know, they are at least all pilots.
The IMDb entry for this is hilarious. Like the poster of just their heads floating in space. It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, be fair, you know, you are selling, much like Armageddon is, you know, really just Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck's faces. You are selling a movie like this on the cast.
It's amazing. Clint Eastwood directed it. Be ashamed of yourself, Clint Eastwood.
But like I say, I remember enjoying it. I don't remember an awful lot about it, but I do remember thinking that was okay.
James Cromwell was in it.
Complete ridiculous. Who's he?
James Cromwell. Did you watch American Horror Story?
Oh, no, but I know who you mean. I've just looked him up on Wikipedia. Yes.
He's also, I mean, I know him as Farmer Hoggett from Babe because that was like a big movie in my childhood.
Yes, of course.
And then he's Zefram Cochrane in Star Trek First Contact, which is the best Star Trek movie.
I know some people who might take issue with that.
I will fight them.
When they're giving the sort of worst case scenarios to the president, and one of them says, nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
That's not how it works!
And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that you don't know how bacteria works, dude.
Like, we've had, like, what, scientists think we've had, like, 6 extinction-level events in the history of the planet? If nothing had survived, not even bacteria, how would we be here? Like,
right. I was just like, what?
I bet Michael Bay's science teachers hate him. Like,
that was one of the moments. I mean, that's even before we get into space. So that was one of the moments where I thought, like, I really hope that whoever the NASA advisors were on this have basically just spent the last 20 years dining out on stories about how they really, really tried to get Michael Bay to listen to them and he wouldn't.
Yeah. I love finding that disclaimer at the end of the credits, like, because they they do all their thank yous and they thank NASA and the Air Force and all the places where they filmed, and they thank the specific people at those places that were really helping them. And then you get to the very end, and I've never seen this in any movie that NASA can, because NASA consults on sci-fi movies all the time. Like, people don't realize how often they do that. And I want to be the dude whose job it is to consult on movies. Like, how cool is that? Like, yeah, I work for NASA. Wow, you work for NASA? What do? I consult on sci-fi and space movies. Like, it's as cool as being an astronaut. Like, but like, when I got to that disclaimer, it's like right underneath the no animals were harmed in the making of this film. I'm just like, NASA doesn't want to be associated with this. And their logo is all over it. Apparently, they considered Arnold Schwarzenegger for the role of Harry Stamper.
Wow.
That would have been a different movie.
Would it, though? Would it? I don't know. I was about to say that. Yeah, that would have been a very different movie. But would it? Really? I don't know. Because it couldn't get much more outlandish or ridiculous or over the top, you know?
Yeah, it says in here, NASA shows this film during their management training program. New managers are given the task of trying to spot as many errors as possible. At least 168 have been found.
168?
Oh, here's a fun fact. After Rockhound, Steve Buscemi's character, gets space dementia, the shuttle crew wraps him in duct tape, which is, in fact, NASA protocol for immobilizing a crazed crew member.
Really? Wow. Yeah. I love that they have a protocol for
that. I do, too. Also, apparently, this is the first movie in which the cast was allowed to use actual NASA spacesuits.
Ah.
They are the only civilians ever to wear NASA spacesuits. They didn't let Tom Hanks wear a NASA spacesuit in Apollo 13? Well, I guess that would have been like old-timey vintage spacesuit.
Right, right. To be fair, they probably didn't have any spacesuits left from the 60s, yeah.
They cost over $3 million each. That's an expensive suit. Because of the patriotic nature of the script and the success of using Top Gun as Air Force recruitment material, the producers persuaded NASA to allow director Michael Bay and company to shoot in the normally restricted space agency. This included the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, the 65-million-gallon pool that they use to train for weightlessness, and the use of two $10 million spacesuits. The crew was also allowed to shoot in the historic launch pad that went out of service after the Apollo 1 disaster, which is a very beautifully shot scene.
I would love, because it's been a while now. I mean, this film is nearly 20 years old. I would love to hear from anyone who was inspired to become a scientist, you know, or an astrophysicist, or like join NASA or a NASA engineer or whatever. Anyone who was actually inspired to become, you know, involved in NASA stuff because of this movie, because I find it unlikely.
Yeah. Bruce Willis refused to work with Michael Bay ever again.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. Wait, but was that because of the end result, or
He did not care for Bay's directing style.
Right, I was going to say, or was it on set stuff? Because Bruce Willis, don't forget, started in sort of Broadway and TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I gather that he is not difficult to work with, but that he has he doesn't have a lot of patience for for certain styles of direction, shall we say.
Well, I would also probably be inclined to believe that Michael Bay is a huge dick, because he is, and has been a dick to many actors he's worked with.
Well, see, I was trying to be diplomatic.
Man, the IMDb trivia page for this movie is just, it's so long and it's so amazing. It's just like a bunch of, like, everyone jokes about acting in it. Steve Buscemi's like, they asked him why he did the film. He's like, I wanted a bigger house.
Oh, that's like
Billy Bob Thornton often jokes about the fact that he like did this film for the money, and he's always like, it's not that bad.
Lots of close-ups of Liv Tyler. Good lord, let me do that one again. Sorry. I'm sorry. Can you hear my dogs in the background?
I was like, you have hounds.